Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the still unclear fate of Utah's national monuments, Representative Chris Stewart's Senate ambitions, the long-term budgetary needs of Operation Rio Grande, wild horses, and more. And with me for this conversation this morning is Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Roger.
Also, public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. Welcome, Brian.
Hey, Roger. How's it going?
Very good. Good morning. And editorial writer Michelle Quist. Welcome to you as well. Good morning.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Listeners, of course, you are welcome to join us during this Friday morning news wrap-up with your questions and comments. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. Well, Brian Maffley, we knew that the deadline for recommendations from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke was coming up. I think it was just yesterday. This is
yesterday,
recommendations on national monuments for across the United States. President Trump had ordered a review of monuments, and that has now been completed, and recommendations have been made. But as of yesterday, at least, we didn't know exactly what those recommendations were going to be or what they were, at least not in any precise sense. Do we have any further information on this?
Yeah, not much.
Okay.
These recommendations are under wraps at the moment, which is annoying to people in the conservation community and Democratic lawmakers. They've voiced a lot of problems with that. What we do know is the recommendations were submitted to the White House yesterday. This is concerning there's 27 monuments total. All we can say definitively right now is what Secretary Zinke's previously said. He's eliminated six monuments from the review, meaning that we won't recommend changes to them.
Okay. We knew this before. I mean, this is what he said after the review was completed.
And then he's also said that the Bear's Ears was too big and needed to be, quote-unquote, right-sized. By how much or, what would be left in? Who knows? My guess is it would be Cedar Mesa and the Bears Ears Buttes and much of the rest of it he'll recommend to have removed. So that's all we know. But now we have the Washington Post and New York Times saying the Grand Staircase Escalante is on the list of monuments he is planning to shrink.
Okay. This all began essentially with an executive order from President Trump, correct?
That's right, in April.
And that was something that was driven by essentially complaints from Utah delegation, but other people as well. Is this accurate to say that the reason or the push for that executive order came from here?
It largely came from Utah. And Senator Hatch was standing right next to Donald Trump on April 25th, 6th, when they signed the executive order. And at that order signing, Trump talked about how some of President Obama's monument designations were a massive land grab and shouldn't have happened. And you got a really good sense of what direction this review was going to head. Which it's worth noting that this is unprecedented for a president to systematically second guess his predecessors on monument designations. So the 27 that were to be reviewed were all in excess of 100,000 acres and had been designated since 1996, which was the year that Bill Clinton designated the Grand Staircase. So it seemed the review was very much fixated on the Grand Staircase. So if there's major reductions being contemplated for any monument, that the staircase would be one. So it's also worth noting that what's also being reported now is that Secretary Zinke is recommending no revocations of monuments. That's
That has to do a little bit with the law. I mean, with the Antiquities Act itself, correct? The fact that you could maybe there have been adjustments to national monuments in the past, none have ever been rescinded.
Yes, some have been rescinded, but it was through congressional action.
Okay,
but there hasn't been an instance where a president rescinded, and there have been instances where presidents have adjusted boundaries, and those weren't particularly controversial. They all predated the passage of the Federal Land Policy Management Act, which, as far as the critics are concerned, that's an important piece of context. So if any, if President Trump follows through with any recommendation to, you know, shrink a monument, it will be instantly challenged in the courts. The Utah Indian tribes that have proposed the Bears Ears have already already got a lawsuit lined up.
You know, in fact, you mentioned those tribes. They are among a number of people who believe that this was kind of, you know, the review process that began back in April was essentially a foregone conclusion, and some of that came in the wake of a visit by Secretary Zinke to national monuments across the United States, but to Utah, and who Secretary Zinke specifically met with, correct?
Yeah, there seemed to be this feeling that he was limiting his meetings with people who are anti-monument.
Can we talk about that review process just in general? There was a space for public comment, and that was an online website. I mean, that was a website at the Interior site.
Yes. Yeah, so regulations.gov is a venue for people to comment on all sorts of things the federal government is reviewing. So 2.8 million people reportedly submitted comments through regulations.gov concerning the monument review. And, you know, some of the analyses of those found that 98-99% of the comments submitted were pro-monument. So yesterday, the Interior Department released a two-page, quote-unquote, summary of Zinke's recommendations that pretty much spelled out a rationale for reducing the size of some of the monuments. And that summary was kind of dismissive of this overwhelming support that was expressed online, saying it was kind of the product of a well-organized campaign by many environmental organizations to, you know, get people to weigh in.
And then circling back to the redrawing of boundaries, we mentioned that Congress has in the past rescinded national monuments, that the president has never done it, but presidents have in the past kind of adjusted here and there the boundaries.
Yeah.
Tell us about how that's happened in the past.
Yeah. The two big instances were the Mount Olympus in Washington and one in Alaska. And in those two instances, there was a national security concern. And for Mount Olympus, it was the United States was about to enter World War I. We needed the timber to build ships for the anticipated war effort, and that monument held amazing timber resources that many felt needed to be available.
Okay, but kind of minor adjustments, correct? I mean,
Mount Olympus, okay. Now Olympus National Park. Was not minor at all.
Okay.
The President Wilson at the time, it must have been half. It was a major reduction in size. Yeah.
I want to just send out a quick reminder to our listeners that you are invited to join this conversation. The number to call is 801-355-8255. What are you expecting from these recommendations by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke? What's your opinion of the National Monument Review process? We'd love to hear from you again. 801-355-8255 is the number to call. Brian, you mentioned legal challenges. And I think that there have been legal challenges to national monument designations in the past. Is there room, I guess, there's room for a legal challenge to these kinds of changes? Is that correct? I think about...
Never been tested.
Never been tested,
yeah.
Okay. Because when the Antiquities Act was used by presidents in the past, it seemed almost watertight that you couldn't then legally challenge the president's decision to declare the monument.
Well, there have been lawsuits dating back to the establishment of Grand Canyon, which was in 1908. I mean, it's very early. I mean, that was within 2 years of the passage of the Antiquities Act, which allows presidents to make these designations. They've all been upheld in the courts. Same with the Grand Staircase Escalante. That was challenged and upheld. Hmm. Yeah. So what hasn't been challenged, because it hasn't really come up yet, is a subsequent president's decision to get rid of or shrink a monument.
Which, of course, we still haven't seen yet. We've seen we know that there are recommendations. We don't know precisely what they are necessarily.
Nor do we know if the recommendations are for President Trump to unilaterally act or have Congress do it. If Congress did it, then it's legally sound. No one's going to dispute that. If Trump does it, There are very strong opinions out there in the legal community that would not be a legal use of executive authority.
Maybe I'll bring Dan Harry, Salt Lake Tribune government editor, in on this. And Dan, we've heard, here in the state of Utah, we've heard the governor speak to the need for stewardship and conservation of public lands. Representatives Bishop and Chaffetz had they put forth a plan for conserving the Bears Ears area that had a number of similarities to the final monument as it was designated by President Obama. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, why are state leaders as opposed as they are to national monument designations like this?
Well, I think it goes to their fundamental philosophy that states' rights have been weakened over the years, and this is a prime example of Washington in the form of the White House, the executive, having unilateral power and kind of being able to dismiss the concerns of the states. So I think it's all tied into that. And of course, we're a huge public land state, like most Western states are. And there's a feeling in a lot of rural communities that, like rural communities all over the country, their economies are shrinking. The old economy is going away, and in many cases, they're blaming, they choose to blame part of that, at least, on this vast amount of federal land that they feel is locked up from their use, from their beneficial use.
Let's bring Tribune editorial writer Michelle Quist in as well. And Michelle, the Tribune, I know, has weighed in on the question of national monuments in the past in various instances, going back to the paper's editorial board, I think a year ago maybe or more, explicitly calling for the designation of the Bears Ears Monument, if I'm not mistaken. The concept of federal public lands in Utah is maybe less popular among our elected officials than elsewhere. I don't know. What do you think of the review process, Michelle? What's going on?
I think the interesting thing in this case is that both sides are now calling a limiting of the monuments as a victory, whereas before the states' rights proponents were saying this needs to be reversed or nothing else. And so I think the public pressure and the idea that conservation of these lands is very important has kind of pushed them towards, okay, we'll be okay if you limit it. Just as long as you give us some kind of something here.
Okay, so essentially, the fact that that it's an adjustment is an outcome that maybe wouldn't have been possible before.
Right,
is what you're saying.
Right.
Brian, does that hold water? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's worth noting that the state legislature passed a resolution asking Trump to rescind the Bears Ears. We're not going to get that. We're going to get probably a severe reduction. And it's also worth noting that Governor Herbert yesterday put out a statement that threw a lot of bones out there to the tribes who sought that designation. And he said, "Look, I'm paraphrasing here, but he acknowledged that there are a lot of special resources in Bears Ears that need to be protected." And he called for legislation to accomplish that and something that'll give the tribes, quote unquote, co-management of the public lands that hold sacred sites for them. So, in a sense, he's saying, we're on the same page with the tribes here. We just think a Antiquities Act monument designation is not the way to go.
And there was, of course, this intertribal coalition advocating for Bears Ears, pointing to that long indigenous history in the region. That coalition includes Hopi, Navajo, Ute Mountain Ute, Zuni, and the Ute Indian tribe. And they were successful in their advocacy for the creation of this national monument. How are they responding to the news that Bears Ears is likely on the, I'd just say chopping block, but the readjustment block, whatever you want to call it?
That the Bears Ears Coalition is deeply opposed to any changes and have vowed to sue over any action by the Trump administration to change those boundaries. In fact, they want the monument to be enlarged. They had sought a 1.9 million acre monument. It was ultimately 1.35 million acres, still super big. It is the third largest national monument in our nation now that the BLM administers. And they wanted the parts of White and Red Canyons included in the monument. They were left out probably because of their uranium resources. Mm. Yeah.
This is sort of an odd question, but is there any sense that President Trump, you know, wouldn't take these recommendations, or is that expected to happen?
I can't even read those tea leaves,
okay,
Roger.
That's fine. That makes sense. When will we know what's in these recommendations?
You know, Congressman Bishop was on a press call yesterday, and he got a lot of heat from the reporters on that call about when are these recommendations going to become public. And he basically said, rather glibly, that, you know, the White House needs to take its time to digest them, review these recommendations, figure out what to do before releasing them to the public and deciding what to do. And anyway, that leaves all these communities on pins and needles about what's going to happen.
Well, and we've talked a lot about the sort of Utah specific responses to the announcement that recommendations have been passed on. How have other states been responding to the fact that their monuments might be changed? And we've heard that two in Utah, Grand Staircase, Escalante, and of course Bears Ears National Monument could be resized. And then, as you said, Washington Post is reporting two others, one other. Yeah, what is that other one?
That one is the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument on the California-Oregon border, which Clinton designated and Obama enlarged. It's still, you know, a small monument compared to the Bears Ears, but it was a controversial one in those rural Oregon counties that depend on timber harvesting. They were pretty upset about that monument, and then to have it enlarged was a stick in their eye. So that one was controversial. The other ones that are getting talked a lot about are the two big ones in New Mexico, Rio Grande del Norte and Oregon Mountain Desert Peaks. And it's interesting that that state Senator Martin Heinrich, a Democrat, held a press conference yesterday really denouncing Zinke's review, vowing to fight to protect those monuments should they be, shrunk a great deal.
A different response than Utah's delegation, which—
Totally different. And, you know, and it's also interesting how the other states have responded when monuments were knocked out of the review. Like when a few weeks ago, the Canyons of the Ancients in Colorado was dropped from the review, and Colorado's Republican Senator Cory Gardner was very praiseworthy of Zinke for doing that. He says, Colorado loves its public lands and wants these special places protected. Thank you, Secretary Zinke. And here in Utah, the attitude is totally different.
And just neighboring states with such
similar issues, yeah.
And completely different ideas.
Yeah.
I want to bring Michelle Quist back into this. Michelle, some of this is certainly economic, prioritizing certain economic activities over others. And I think you could say that on either side of the argument. But some of this has to be politically motivated as well, talking about that division between what Colorado thinks and what Utah thinks, essentially Democratic versus Republican presidencies and the outcomes that they produce.
Right. And, you know, I think that the question here and the ability to take a win would be if Zinke recommends legislative action as opposed to executive authority. That's the problem, or at least the problem they say they have, is this executive authority. You know, when Obama, made the monument, it was, oh, my gosh, he shouldn't do that. It should be congressional. And so they should be saying the same thing now that Trump is president as a Republican. It should be a congressional action. There's nothing right now stopping Representative Bishop of putting in legislation that says, hey, let's reduce Bears Ears and let's give the Indian tribes the control that they were given in this monument designation. They were giving consulting. They have no recourse for that. You know, okay, I'll consult. But a statute that says that they have some kind of power or authority would go so much further.
Hmm. Brian, just before we should probably move on to a break here in a moment, but that makes me think of the Public Lands Initiative, again, going back to Representative Bishop and this plan to conserve the area that was outside of a national monument designation. Tell us why, but that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it didn't go anywhere because Congressman Bishop waited till very late in the process to introduce his legislation, which was very comprehensive. It included much of eastern Utah, and it included provisions for national conservation areas for the Bears Ears region. Interestingly, the designation that did come down after the failure of that legislation hewed really closely to what Bishop had proposed in his bill. But there were so many problems with that legislation. It was filled with provisions that a lot of environmental groups would not agree to. Exemptions to the Wilderness Act, provisions that would prevent future Antiquities Act designations, things like that, that they just couldn't live with.
The tribal coalitions had walked away from it, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Other than the size of the thing, an entirely different nuts and bolts detailed document.
Yeah, I know. So President Obama waited until to give that legislation, which was in the works for 3 or 4 years, every opportunity to succeed, and it failed without a vote in either body of Congress. Mm-hmm. So he acted in the last couple weeks of his term.
Right. Brian, we will look for your follow-ups to the story, and it'll be interesting to see the actual details when they're no longer secret. But right now, we do need to head to our first break of the show. Thanks very much for this, though, Brian. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be right back.
On the next On Being, Nikki Giovanni, a revolutionary poet during the civil rights movement, now an adored teacher to a new generation.
If it's one thing that I definitely enjoy, it's my 8 o'clock class. They come to me 8 a.m. They come to me from their dreams, and I come to them from mine.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us.
Join us Sunday night at 5 on Utah Public Radio.
On American Roots, it's fiddler and singer Alison Krauss on her journey through bluegrass and country from small-town Illinois to Nashville. Then it's Hooray for the Riff Raff, a New Orleans folk band with roots in the Bronx, fronted by Alinda Segarra. That plus music from Chuck Berry, Nina Simone, and Tom Waits. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Join us Saturday night at 8 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, environment and public lands reporter Brian Maffley, and editorial writer Michelle Quist Mumford. You can call us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. And to politics now, Dan Harry, or maybe more politics, I should say. It seems like there are a number of pretenders to the Senate seat that Senator Orrin Hatch currently holds. He's held for 40 years now. The most recent interest in that seat is coming from another member of our delegation in Washington, and that's Representative Chris Stewart. Tell us about this.
Yeah, Chris Stewart was in the editorial board meeting, and I'm sure Michelle was there and heard this. I wasn't in the meeting. And said that I guess he was pressed rather firmly on this issue, and said that if Senator Hatch decided not to run again, that he would indeed like to seat that seat. That would be the beginning of a long line of folks. If the senator does announce, which now their indication is kind of it's going to be October, I think.
And that's announcing whether or not he will.
Right. And I don't know. I mean, from what I see publicly, everything seems to be pointing to him running again. Hmm. For one thing, if you are going to step down, generally speaking, you would announce that fairly early on to give the other candidates time to, establish their campaigns. It's going to be a tough, long race.
Well, hold on, Dan, just to interrupt you there for a second, I mean, he did announce that really early. He said that this term would be his last term. But
he said that last election.
Yeah.
And now that's all forgotten because so many folks have just begged and pleaded with the senator to stay in, as he tells us. Now, our polling shows that Republicans in Utah have still very high approval ratings of Senator Hatch. They think he's doing a good job. Independents and Democrats do not. But even the Republicans who think he's doing a very good job do not want him to seek reelection. They think 7 is enough. So,
I'm going to bring Michelle Quist, who was at the editorial meeting that Chris Stewart made this statement at, and it sounded like he wasn't ready to answer that question. And then the Tribune pressed him, and he had to essentially commit to making a statement there.
Yeah, he tried at first to say, oh, you know, don't ask, but and I think that's out of respect for Senator Hatch, who, you know, they get along really well with. But he was questioned again about it, and in no uncertain terms said, yes, I'm seeking that seat. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I might, I'm still thinking about it. It was, yes, if Hatch doesn't run, I'm seeking that seat.
You're an editorial writer, and from Dan Harry, I was getting the straight journalism responses about polling, but I'd love to hear your direct opinion. And I should say, too, that I've pointed this out before, but that you have a history with the Republican Party here in Utah, and I have kind of a two-part question. Part one is pretty simple. Should Orrin Hatch run for an eighth term, Michelle?
No, okay. He should not. We do not need a 90-year-old senator in place. And that's not to denigrate his age, but it's just, you know, like Dan said, 7 terms is enough. I've been hearing that he's going to run but not fulfill the 6 years. We don't need another of that either. You know, we're in the middle of that with Representative Chaffetz dropping out in mid-session. And, you know, if he doesn't intend to go 6 years, then he should not run.
Well, the other part of this is something that Dan alluded to, which is that the guessing game that that Orrin Hatch has everybody else engaged in. What does that mean for the other candidates who are waiting in the wings? And maybe we'll get to who those are as well, because there seem to be quite a few of potential candidates.
Yeah, I'm surprised somebody hasn't stepped out yet and just said, you know, even though Hatch hasn't said anything, I'm gonna put my foot in the ring here, because there's one, it's likely that he, or it's, there's a question whether he will run, but two, it's the right thing to do. I mean, it's already August; it's almost September, and these campaigns need a long time to get their message out. At least that's what we want. You know, the people want more time to hear the message, and I think we'll see some people coming out, but I think they should have already started.
Let's see if we can get any listener voices in on this question of Orrin Hatch running for an eighth term or not. The number to call is 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, other names that have been floated for this include, at one point, Jason Chaffetz, although maybe that's not as likely as it is anymore.
I don't know this, but I think that it would be hard for Jason to run for that seat now, because he left Congress, as you remember, in June, saying he wanted to spend more time with his family. So for him to turn around and run for that Senate seat next year, I think the hypocrisy of that would be just a little bit too much.
Others include Mitt Romney, who at one point
Mitt has indicated that he does not want to run for that seat.
Okay.
But a lot of people are talking about his son, Josh Romney, who lives here in Utah and certainly has political aspirations. He's also often mentioned as a candidate for governor. But so we could see a Romney if Hatch steps aside. I don't think that Josh Romney would get into it if Orrin Hatch is running again.
Is there anybody who said, yes, I will run, whether or not Hatch steps down from the Republican side?
I don't think he said this directly, but Derek Miller has said that he or has indicated that he would probably run, and I think he's got a campaign going up. You know, the biggest threat to Hatch, if he did run, would have been John Huntsman,
right,
Jr., and I think Orrin helped take care of that with his appointment as ambassador to Russia, or his nomination. And, you know, we expect that to happen now. Mm-hmm. Should mention, of course, as always, that his brother Paul, Huntsman, is the owner and publisher of the Salt Lake Tribune.
Some full disclosure. Are we leaving any big names out of the Republican field of candidates? I mean,
Probably, but...
Okay.
But people are not talking about it. And, you know, it does beg the question of if indeed somebody was going to challenge Hatch, why haven't they stepped forward yet? Hmm. You know, the election is still a long ways away, but for a Senate race, you've got to start very early.
Treading lightly, I guess. On the Democratic side, though, there's a candidate who's already announced. This is Salt Lake County Councilwoman Jenny Wilson, who's the daughter of former Salt Lake City Mayor Ted Wilson.
And one of the Democrats who ran against Orrin Hatch and actually did better than any other Democrat since Orrin knocked Ted Moss out of the Senate. And, in 1976.
And so the race that Ted Wilson ran against against Orrin Hatch was the most competitive.
It was the most competitive, but it was still like, I think, if I'm remembering, a 15 or 16 percentage point gap.
When was the last Democrat? Was Frank Moss the last Democratic senator that we had from Utah?
Mm-hmm. Okay. 76.
Well, Dan, we started this conversation talking about Representative Chris Stewart and his interest in the seat. And he came, as we know, and spoke with the editorial board of the Tribune. And he's been here in his home district. There have been a number of stories that the Tribune's Courtney Tanner has been reporting on. Stewart meeting with refugees, visiting inmates at the state prison. Is there an impetus for his visit to his home district and these various events that he's doing?
Well, I don't know, but it certainly is refreshing to see a congressman who's coming back and spending a lot of time out in the public meeting these different constituencies, whereas we've seen the other members of Congress sort of hunker down, avoid the town hall meetings. You know, Mia Love's tried to limit it to these very small groups in her office of 10 or 11 people, and she's got police officers stationed outside. She's worried about threats and that kind of thing. But, you know, it's supposed to be the people's house, and you expect those folks to have some interaction with real people. And unfortunately, in today's politics, that doesn't happen all that often. So, you know, I'm glad to see Representative Stewart do this. It does obviously raise the question. He's trying to raise his profile. I mean, you look at polling numbers, Chris Stewart— and I should know this, but I don't. I think he's in his third term. Is that right?
Sorry.
Something like that. Anyway, very few people know who Chris Stewart is. Very high don't know ratings when we poll on Chris Stewart.
You mentioned, well, again that uptick in hometown activity at the same time that we hear about his potential Senate run is kind of interesting. Michelle Quist, do you have any? I mean, I don't want to be cynical that's the motive. It would be great if that's not the motive.
No, right. And he mentioned a lot of his time is spent in international travel because he has a lot of these foreign relations committee assignments. You know, I was impressed when he came and talked to the editorial board. When he didn't agree with, one of the questions or where obviously the editorial board was coming from, he was very forthcoming. He didn't try to give a politic answer. He was, he was honest and okay to disagree with us, and he was there. And so I was impressed.
Okay. Dan, you mentioned, seeing more sort of local activity. There is a town hall tonight. This is Representative Rob Bishop is holding a town hall in Layton, Utah. I don't know the time. I think it's 7 p.m. You can check it out. There's a Facebook invite out there somewhere. So just while Stuart, we'll go to a break here in a moment, but one of the things that Stewart did was visit with Utah's refugee community, some of whom have expressed frustrations with President Trump. And Aiden Batar, who is director of refugee resettlement for Catholic Community Services here in Utah, expressed frustrations that had to do with the president's travel ban and the lowered number of refugees being accepted to the United States. How did Stewart deal with that?
Well, I think he's trying to walk a tightrope. You know, Chris Stewart is known for, wanting to be tough on terrorism. And he often talks about the threat to the United States that's out there. And I think on most of these issues, he falls down on the side of security. But I think he does have, some sympathy for the refugees. And, Utah has this reputation and actually lives up to the reputation as being a welcoming haven for refugees. And so I think he's trying to walk that fine line.
Okay. Some interesting coverage and a lot of stories on his various activities here at sltrib.com. We need to head to another quick break before we move on to other topics from this past week's news. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. It's the weekly news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. We'll be back shortly.
Next time on Ask Me Another, we're joined by former U.S. Poet Laureate Rita Dove And before she was winning Pulitzer Prizes and collecting honorary degrees, she was naming characters in her own comic books.
Well, we had our typical superheroes, Jet Boy, Jet Girl, and their dog, Jet Zumino.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Join us Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
On the next Radio Lab.
We now know who paid $350,000 to kill an endangered black rhino in Namibia.
We are at war.
Two sides fight over one rhino.
Killing wild animals so that they can be looked after. Yeah. Utterly ridiculous.
And a critical question.
How do we really value this animal's survival on Earth?
That's on the next Radio Lab.
Join us this Saturday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Brian Maffley, and Michelle Quist-Mumford. Listeners, call us up with your questions and your comments. The number is 801-355-TALK. And public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley, we kick the show off with you and a conversation about the Interior Secretary's recommendations. Details to follow on national monuments. I want to now turn to another story that has to do with the Interior Department, and it has to do also with wild horses. The recommendation from a senior Interior official is essentially for a cull of wild horse and burro herds.
Using lethal measures.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell us about these recommendations and where they were made, actually.
Sure. For a little background, the Bureau of Land Management gets the awesome challenge of managing the wild horses on public lands in the western states. And that's under a law passed in 1971 protecting wild horses and burros. These aren't native animals to the west, although there are, you know, there was an equine species that was in North America that went extinct after the Ice Age. Yeah. So they've come back to the west because of European exploration. They brought horses. They got loose. They're out on the range. They are now proliferating.
What kind of numbers are we talking about?
Well, according to the BLM, there are now 73,000 wild horses and burros on public lands in the western states. It sounds like when you include the tribal lands, there's even a lot more. Mm. But the federal government doesn't have management over those. So that is three times more number of horses and burros than these horse management areas can comfortably sustain, again, according to the BLM. The horse advocate groups totally dispute these numbers. Mm. And because of the damage these horses are allegedly doing to the range and to themselves, starving and to death, and pushing ranchers, cows off the land, it's become a hugely controversial issue in the western states.
I mean, is that the real brunt of this issue is the conflict between wild horses on rangeland essentially eating the same food that that cattle would be eating?
That's basically the source of the conflict. Yeah.
What's the recommendation that this Interior official, and this was at a conference here in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Tell us about that conference and this recommendation.
Sure. Okay. Utah legislature set aside $500,000 in the last session to figure out ways to reduce wild horse and burro populations. And some of that money was used to host this conference in downtown Salt Lake City, and it was invitation only. Mostly, the folks who were there were mostly folks from rural communities or groups that, wildlife agencies, departments of agriculture in the western states, groups that were trying to figure out this problem of wild horses through removing them from the range. So there are many, many groups that are deeply opposed to removing wild horses. Mm. And they were deliberately excluded from this summit, and they made a big stink out of it and denounced it as the quote-unquote slaughter summit, which is a little bit, I thought, hysterical, but in a sense, I think it was fair. I mean, everything that I heard talked about at the summit on Wednesday was about giving the BLM the quote-unquote tools to manage these these horses and these tools involved lethal measures. Mm. They don't ever say it. They kind of talk in euphemisms. But
if you could not talk in euphemisms, what kind of lethal measures might those be?
Well, there was a senior interior official there named Aurelia Skipwith. She's a recent appointee. You said, look, we need to lift restrictions on unrestricted sales and allow for quote-unquote humane euthanasia. Both those terms are kind of problematic because unrestricted sales really means selling to slaughterhouses.
Commercial slaughterhouses for meat?
Meat and other products, okay. Yeah. Maybe dog food, but they don't. But they won't say what they really mean there when they say unrestricted sales. And also, humane euthanasia is that term can't be applied to a healthy animal. Euthanasia means putting someone or something out of its misery because they're sick and old and dying. This kind of a misuse of the English language really has annoyed the horse advocates who feel like they're. Like the state of Utah and other states are kind of concealing what their real agenda is.
Okay. And I just quickly, Brian, I understand that at this conference also the media was at some point barred from attending. Is that accurate?
Yeah. We were only allowed to attend Wednesday's session. And, of course, there was a session Thursday that we weren't invited to.
Are there any common ground solutions between the people who are advocating for wild horses not being managed this way and the BLM people? I mean, is there some common ground?
Absolutely. Well, maybe not, but the horse advocate groups, their alternative is to provide fertility control to the mares on the range and then put them back on the range. That's what they would like to see happen as an alternative to rounding up. Here's some important background we haven't talked about yet. Is there's already 50,000 or so horses in permanent storage for life. It's costing the BLM $50 million a year to take care of those horses. So, and that's kind of what's driving the Trump administration to wanting to quote-unquote euthanize horses. It's costing the taxpayers millions of dollars to take care of these horses off the range. So what the horse advocates would like is for the BLM to administer a fertility control, it's known by the acronym PCP, that will keep a mare from getting pregnant for a year or two, and then it needs to be readministered. And so the BLM, they had a BLM official at the conference saying, look, that is not practical. We can't afford. It costs us $2,600 every time we immunize a mare. And, you know, when you talk about 73,000 horses on the range, it's a daunting task.
Okay. You know, Brian, it's a really interesting story, and I'm just looking at the time that we have left, and maybe I will point people to sltrib.com. Are we expecting a policy change, though, in the near term as a result of these recommendations at this conference?
Yeah, well, it's kind of up to Congress to lift restrictions on the sales and killing of horses. Right now, it's not allowed under BLM's own policies and congressional action from a few years ago. So the Trump administration would like to see those lifted, and if Congress agrees, they'll get it lifted, and BLM will, under the Trump administration's leadership, will probably move forward on killing horses, and it'll be a massively controversial project that would be resisted by a lot of these groups.
Okay. Okay, as I said, we don't have a lot of time remaining in the show. And Dan Harry, who's government editor at the Salt Lake Tribune, I did want to get to a piece of reporting that appeared in the Tribune, some reporting on the update that state and local leaders provided on Wednesday on Operation Rio Grande. We heard some numbers of arrests. We heard where Operation Rio Grande had come to. And again, this is an operation in the homeless area, I guess, around the Rio Grande Depot downtown, where there's been a homeless encampment. What did this update provide us?
Well, I think it's just trying to keep the legislature up to date, and mainly, I think it's kind of to give them a warning that the legislature has appropriated some money for this. Mm. they're not done appropriating. That was the main message that I think they were trying to convey was, look, this effort is massive, it's expensive, and we're going to be coming back to you asking for more money. They won't say how much more money. There is, a list that is in the hands of a very few folks that are leading this effort. But so far, they have been unwilling to share that. So we don't know what the amount is.
We know just more money.
And
it's for a sustained law enforcement effort. Is it also for increased treatment for
people
suffering? Yes,
absolutely. Absolutely. And, one of the things that they've been doing right now that's very expensive is they have an average of about, 150 officers from local and state police and the county that are out there in the Rio Grande area every day. And, you're looking at paying overtime to those officers, and that adds up very quickly.
There have been some concerns that crime is being driven to other parts of Salt Lake City, the West Side, for example, and Public Safety Commissioner Keith Squires said that officers would essentially, during this update, pursue criminal activity wherever
right.
it went.
They're claiming that they're keeping an eye on this, that they're surveilling it. They have developed a hotline for people to call in the neighborhoods and to report if they see this criminal activity and homelessness moving into their neighborhoods. And they promise that they will act upon that. And they say they know that it's going to spread. They say they know that that will be the initial reaction, that it will start breaking up in the Rio Grande area and move into other areas. They claim that they are prepared to handle that. We'll see. The treatment aspect really probably will be end up being the most expensive. And they really have not begun to address that yet. I mean, they've kind of scrambled to get this thing underway. And from the outside looking in, and what it looked like was they were all about securing jail beds and manpower and kind of the strategizing on the law enforcement side of this. And they really hadn't yet secured treatment slots. Right now the treatment is all full. Basically what you need to do is you need to open up new treatment slots, and that's very expensive.
Well, in this update, I know that House Speaker Greg Hughes sort of alluded to the idea that once you kind of take away the criminal element, and the people supplying the drugs, you'll have more people seeking treatment. That was kind of his
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, I can probably think that he's getting that from the head of the DEA here, and that's sort of been their traditional response is, go after the supply. It hasn't worked too well as a policy for our country over the last 30 years.
More on drugs. Michelle Quist Mumford, comments on Operation Rio Grande. I know that the Tribune has essentially been cautiously optimistic about this.
Yeah, I think the first phase has gone well. Law enforcement phase was important, but the second phase, the treatment of people that need mental help, or drug treatment, is more important. And I hope that they don't run out of money before they get there.
Okay. And if we don't know what kind of money we're talking about, that would have to be allocated, I guess, by the state legislature, Dan?
Yes. They also want to see that the Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County chip in money, too. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, a good portion of that's going to have to come from the state.
Okay. Well, guys, we were going to have to leave it there because our time is up. But Dan Harry, thanks again. And what this means is that it's time now for our final segment of the show, our underplayed stories of the week. And Dan Harry, maybe I'll start with you.
Okay. There's been an argument this week that was up in the Capitol over concealed carry permit fees. There was a $20 increase that the agency says it had to pass on because of the FBI policies on fingerprinting. Mm. And in essence, legislators are saying you didn't have authority to do this, so you should do away with it. They haven't taken action yet. It looks like they're poised to do so. And what that means in the interim, unless the legislature acts, is that we will be subsidizing out-of-state gun permit holders, because right now two-thirds of the permits issued by the state are out-of-state folks.
Hmm. Who come here specifically to get that
permit? They don't come here. They get trained elsewhere. they meet the requirements of Utah law, and they get their permits in the mail.
All right. Well, fascinating. Check it out at sltrip.com. Brian Maffley, your pick for an underplayed story.
Yeah, my colleague Emma had this interesting story. Emma Penrod, environmental reporter, had a really interesting story about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission wanting the state of Utah to demonstrate how it was going to pay for the Lake Powell pipeline, a $1.5 billion proposal to pipe water from Lake Powell across southern Utah to Washington County. And for quite some time now, Washington County Water District has said, oh, we have a plan to pay for it without passing on the cost to Utah taxpayers. But no one's really ever seen the plan. And now, well, the federal government would like to see the plan.
And that will that mean that we will see the plan soon?
No.
Okay.
They have a 60-day deadline given, and Emma tells me that there's no way the state's going to meet that deadline.
Okay. All right. That's an interesting one, too. SLTrip.com. Check it out. Michelle Quist-Mumford, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I think this story about Utah Valley University being now under investigation for Title IX violations, making it the fifth higher education institution out of 10 in Utah to be under investigation for such violations. I think that's a big deal. That our universities don't know how to investigate these claims and are perhaps violating civil rights of students on both sides of the problems is a big problem.
5 of 10. I mean, half. Well,
Michelle, was Utah State one of the five?
Utah State? Yeah. No, not yet.
See, that's interesting because our reporting on Utah State is shown some problems there.
Right. Well, and that's if it is soon, which we suspect it to be, then it'll be half of the state-run institutions.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So. For my part, I'm going to go with a story that appeared last weekend in the Tribune that I wanted to ask Dan Harry about, but that we didn't have time for. It was about a landfill or a planned landfill at Promontory Point on the Great Salt Lake. Some questions about the kind of waste that they'll be taking in there, and there's local opposition that is mounting. It was a reporting that's done by a Tribune partner. I don't know if partnership is the right terminology for it or how to describe it.
Yeah, it's the reporter is Ben Empey. And Chris Federer took the photos, and they were working with the Tribune in partnership with the Utah Investigative Journalism Project.
Okay.
And, you know, the interesting aspect of that is that the landfill folks have all along been saying publicly that they only want to take in-state waste. And what they're doing behind the scenes in state documents show is they're preparing to bring in millions of tons of industrial waste, including coal ash, from out of state.
Okay, well, check it out at sltrip.com. Dan Harry, Brian Maffley, and Michelle Quist, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you once again for being here. Guys.
Hey, thanks,
Roger. Thanks.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW up in Logan at Utah Public Radio. The broadcast is managed by Tom Williams, Spencer Hulsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. And thanks to producer Emily Means. You can find podcasts of all of KCPW's local shows at kcpw.org or via your favorite podcast app. In fact, why not subscribe to all of our local shows that way? I'm Roger McDonough, and you've been listening to Behind the Headlines. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great weekend.
I'm Melissa Robinson, the arts and culture reporter for Utah Public Radio. UPR is a community-based organization, and we want to hear from you. What do you want to hear on the radio? Tell us about your experiences with arts and culture. Please visit our website at upr.org or call us at 1-800-826-1495. You can also share ideas with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just be sure to include the hashtag IAmUPR.
Listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.